It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at COTA.com.
This is the Goalkeepers Union Podcast.
Kitson. Now Constable. Curtis goes down. Williams plays on. And that's a fine save from Bartlett.
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union Podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with this week's guest whose rapid rise in the world of goalkeeper coaching hasn't gone unnoticed. Described by his current manager as high-level, hard-working and very committed, he does sterling work in a good goalkeeping team, as he did as a player too, racking up more than 500 appearances with the likes of Hereford, Hartlepool, Gateshead and York. He earned multiple Player of the Year awards and even bagged international recognition. Now, head of goalkeeping at Newcastle United, Adam Bartlett. Welcome to the Goalkeepers Union Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here. Lovely to be here.
Yeah.
In this fine establishment.
Have you enjoyed yourself?
I've loved it. Yeah. Loved the morning. It's been great looking at training, being at the... Is there a name for this training ground or just the Newcastle United training ground?
Yeah, Darsley Park Training Centre.
Darsley Park. Yeah. Lovely. It's been slightly refurbed in recent times.
The last 12 to 18 month, a lot of work done in the building. So yeah, it's a top level facility at the moment. So yeah, lucky to have it.
Two things I actually noticed. Actually, before we get onto that, quick fire questions. Mm-hmm. I always forget. We have quick fire questions to begin every single podcast. So the first one of those is, what gloves did you wear or do you continue to wear as a goalkeeper coach?
As a goalkeeper coach at the moment, I wear the one glove. So yeah, good relationship with Rob and Miles.
Yeah.
Top glove. Top glove, obviously Martin wears them as well, so Martin's wearing them currently at this moment in time, and yeah, big fan. When I was a player, this probably doesn't sound great, but anything I could get my hands on for either at cost or cheap price, let's say, anything for free as well was always a bonus. It sounds bad saying that now, doesn't it? But I guess ultimately when you have a career in the lower levels of the English game, and never probably earned financially a great deal of money, so anything that I could get in that regard that was slightly less was always something I looked for.
So whatever was forthcoming.
Yeah, pretty much. At the same time, I wore some good gloves. I remember wearing, let's say, brands that are either up and coming or brands that are trying to make it onto the market. So I remember as a player when I played at Hereford, I wore Pro GK. When I played at Gateshead, I wore K goalkeeping gloves, so Kenny Arthur's goalkeeping gloves, and yeah, all top-level gloves. Doesn't always have to be your big brands, your Nikes, your Pumas, your Adidases, or whatever it might be. I think a lot of the times the gloves that are up and coming on the market are often the better ones.
Next one, favourite kit.
Ooh, favourite kit. Newcastle obviously going back to Adidas next season. I think we had some great Adidas goalkeeping strips over the year. But I think for me as a younger guy, when I first started to fall in love with football, Newcastle was sponsored by Asics at the time. Asics, however you do describe it. And Pavel Cernicek was my first hero. And Pav used to wear this multicoloured pink, purple, blue Asics goalkeeping strip. And I used to absolutely love it. A little bit further down the line, when Adidas came into play, Newcastle had this orange, yellow, black goalkeeping top that had the Tyne Bridge engraved into it in black as well. And that was a pearler of a strip as well. So they were two of my early favourites as a young man.
They were great strips, weren't they? Do you know what? I don't know whether this is the case, but the inspiration for that Cernicek, it was Cernicek and Shaka Hislop,
yes,
I think it
was,
wore that kit, wasn't it? I think a couple of other teams in the league might have worn it. But it was a while back. I was in my bed at night, and I think I had a torch on or something. But suddenly I noticed a reflection on the roof or the walls, and it was those flecks.
Right.
So I don't know whether that was something that was born out of a designer at Asics and they saw that at home and then they put it onto a goalkeeper top. I don't know whether that is the story.
Okay.
But that they were definitely the flecks
from
a light at night or a reflection or something like that at night.
Right.
So we'll have to find that out, I think, from Asics at some point. Most memorable save that you've ever made?
Okay, the one that would stick out my head would have been playing for Gateshead against Grimsby, playoff semi-final in the National League. We were away at Grimsby. It was 1-1 leading into half-time. Ball came in, Alex Rodden header at the near post, and I turned it over the crossbar. We went on to draw the game 1-1. We won the replay, or the second leg, sorry, 3-1 at home, got ourselves to a Wembley playoff final. But I think that was always the one for me that stuck in my head as something, because playing in front of maybe, what, 5,000-6,000 fans, Blundell Park at Grimsby. The Gateshead fans were behind the goal as well, so I got a little bit of a ripple after the event, leading into half-time as well. I think it was like a pivotal moment in the tie, let's say.
Two more quick ones. Goalkeeping icon, you kind of half-answered that with Pavel Cernicek.
Yeah, so Pav as a young lad, so when I first came into goalkeeping, kind of 7, 8, 9 years old, Pav was the number one for Newcastle, so he was the one that I looked up to as inspiration. Shaka came not long after that, but Pav at that point was already firmly stuck in my mind as my hero. And then along came Shay Given. And Shay, for somebody like me, I was a goalkeeper, I ended up having a career, but being 6 foot, kind of my teenage years, looking at Shay, a goalkeeper that was establishing himself as not only a Premier League goalkeeper, but an elite Premier League goalkeeper, an elite international level goalkeeper. He was somebody that inspired me to think, actually, if I didn't get the physicality and I wasn't able to get the height, let's say, that's required to play in the Premier League level, you still have an opportunity to be a smaller goalkeeper as long as you've got the athleticism, the agility, the speed. And Shea had that in abundance. So it did go from Pav to Shea, but between the two of them, it would be a close match between who the overall favourite is.
And last one, best goalkeeper you've either played with or against?
I mean, Shea, obviously, having the opportunity to train at a full-time level, he was phenomenal to watch on a daily basis. He was making saves in training that were literally incredible. Absolutely incredible. Not just off anybody, off, you know, your Alan Shearer, your Craig Bellamy's, your Patrick Cliver. It's like the type of effort that would come at his goal and he would repel in some way, shape or form was absolutely phenomenal. He had an unbelievable ability to keep the ball out of the back of the net. So I would go with Shea, but at the same time, going into the senior level, I would go with Trevor Carson.
Okay.
So, yeah, when I was at Hartlepool, Trev was a Northern Ireland international at the time. We were both roughly the same age, so kind of 29, 30 years old. And I came in knowing that I was going to be back up to Trev, but I was fortunate in a roundabout way that he got an injury in the pre-season. I know you don't wish an injury on anybody, but that was the way I got an opportunity in the team at that time. And Trev had broke his toe, missed the first 15 games, got the first 15 games in. And then once he got back after that point and he got himself into the team, I just couldn't displace him. Like, he was not League Two level at that time. He could kick the ball well off either foot. He had, again, a natural ability to not always be technical. And I had a very technical upbringing as a goalkeeper. You know, the coaches I worked with from a young level, obviously Simon Smith, Adam Sadler, Terry Geno, very, very technically based. And Trev had worked with Pruds for obviously a long time at Sunderland, and that's not to say that, you know, Pruds isn't technical in the work that he does, but Trev had an ability probably similar to Nick Pope now, where the ball's half a yard outside the left side or the right side of your body and he just would throw a hand up at it, throw an arm up at it, make a save with a forearm, that steel arm, let's say. And that was something I could never do. And I don't know if it was because of the technical upbringing and trying to move your feet in behind the back line of the ball and trying to make it look technical, let's say, he would just not be that way inclined, and you just stick an arm out or stick a leg out. And looking at it now, and again, whether it's Trev or whether it's Nick, they were just unbelievably effective in the actions as a goalkeeper to make a save. And yeah, throughout the next kind of 18 months trying to displace him, I just couldn't. And I think that you have an understanding, and at some point in your career, that there's people that you're working with and people that you train with on a daily basis that are, unfortunately for yourself, just at a better level.
Even when you're observing it. So like you said there, making the types of saves that he was making and you felt like you just couldn't physically do that. Even when you're observing it to try and find that in your game, you weren't able to adapt.
No, I think, again, kind of, I was never fantastic with the ball, let's say. I improved throughout the time, and I think I improved a lot of it through coaching as well, the fact that you would serve as a coach. So I was kind of a part-time coach throughout a lot of my playing career. And I remember one of the early days with Trev. I remember Tony Keogh was the goalkeeping coach at Hartlepool. I remember doing a crossing session. After the cross, you just distribute the ball back out to Keogh. And I remember putting a ball in, coming and catching, throwing it out wide. And I remember Trev coming and catching it and side volleying one. And he had a beautiful side volley technique. So he side volleyed one with his right. And I'm thinking, all right, that's nice. He obviously strikes a ball well. It was early into working with him. Strikes a nice ball. And then the ball came in again, comes and catches it. Side volleys it with his left. Beautiful. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm in trouble here. Because I, like, you know, my left foot was for standing on. I'd never worked at it enough as a young lad. I think I was probably one of them that avoided weaknesses. You know, you look back now as a coach and you think, why didn't I work on certain things? And I think I would have thought it would have exposed what I wasn't very good at. So avoiding crosses, for example, I wasn't great at commanding the area. I'd prefer to be a reactive lane goalkeeper because I knew I was quick and I knew I was athletic, agile. I'd prefer to let the defenders deal with it and what they couldn't. I'd prefer to be on the line and trying to react to what I seen on the back of that. Whereas realistically, I should have been doing crossing practice after crossing practice, trying to get a better line to ball, trying to get time and trying to get braver in terms of coming through body, taking impact. And it would have been the same with my left foot. Couldn't work with my left foot, didn't practice it enough, wish I had now. And, you know, Trevor was a good example of that when he looked at somebody that it wasn't just a case of he was naturally gifted. It was something that, whether it was through Sunderland's academy at the time and what he worked as a young lad, but he got himself into a point where he could kick the ball as well with his right as he could his left. And it became, again, at the lower levels, and he's gone on to have a career in the SPL on the back of that. Yeah, it became such a weapon for him that, again, I wish I could have had.
Okay, well, we're certainly going to get into more of that, I think, in terms of what you've brought into your coaching game. But we are, as things stand, so for context, we are towards the back end of the 23-24 campaign, a few games to go. Nick Pope has been out for a period. He's now on his way back, should hopefully get some game time before the season is out. Today was a rehab session,
yes,
you'd call it, for Nick Pope. So a couple of things I jotted down upon watching the session, observing the session. The first one, heavily watered the area beforehand.
Yes.
Like heavily watered, yeah, the area. You were there with those sprinklers, really giving it a good old go.
Yeah, well, in Premier League football, anytime they turn up to a stadium, anytime the ball, you know, and come kick off, that's the condition that they're going to go into. So there's no point in doing a session, whether it's a basic handling session, whether it's a crossing session, whether it's a passing session. Like, you want to try and recreate the atmosphere that they're going to be in regard to the surface that they play with. So if it's bone dry, that's not what it's going to be like on a Saturday for them. It's not what it's going to be like on a Tuesday night. The only thing that you can't kind of work toward is the wind. So it was a bit blustery out there today. But yeah, we try and replicate the conditions as best as we can, because again, if it's a dry surface using dry football, that's not what it's going to be like on a weekend. So even catching a basic ball, it's not going to feel the same. So you kind of want to have the area as slick as possible, as wet as possible, so that you are replicating each and every action that they are going to see on a Saturday.
Those balls are great, by the way. I was just kept hoping that one was going to come my way so I could just knock it back. All you want to do when you're watching a session like that, you just want to be a part of it in some way. And even you're the pleb who stood on the side of the pitch with a cup of tea watching it, you want to just be able to kick, yeah, one back. It's lovely. Yeah. And the other thing I jotted down was very consistent delivery. And that is on your part.
Okay.
Very impressive, mate.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, yeah. Enjoy going out, enjoy sticking the balls in. But again, when you do it, I think that you just try and replicate what they're going to see. I think that, you know, goalkeeping coaching has moved on from somebody going out wide and hanging a few nice balls up into the air. I think that you've got to try and wrap them in. You've got to try and put them at pace. You've got to try and make it, again, match realistic, because the top and bottom of it is whoever you're playing in the Premier League, if they have... So, for example, when I was on the left side today, I was obviously delivering with the right. Again, going back to the fact that I can't kick a ball with me left, it was the only thing I was going to be able to deliver with. But delivering from the right, it's like an inverted winger. If you are playing away at Liverpool, if you're playing away at Man United, however it might look, if they have an inverted winger, they're not going to cut inside and dolly something up for the goalkeeper to come and take. You know, football isn't that anymore. They're going to cut inside and they're going to wrap something. It's probably going to be just past head height the majority of the way with pace, and the goalkeeper's going to have a decision to make. Again, it's why we try and, you know, have the bodies coming in with the pads, for example, or somebody getting across his eye line. It's why you try and have the blow-ups in there as well, so that they've got to see things, they've got to have potential impact, and they've got to have a decision to make with it. Because, again, going back to the game, especially at this level, that is the game.
Mm. What's he like to work with, Nick? Because he's been one heck of a signing for the club, a signing that you were heavily involved in.
Yeah, well, he obviously had a season at Burnley where he was very much standout. I think he'd had years at Burnley where he was standout. You know, he'd been such a consistent performer for them over the four seasons prior to coming into to Newcastle. I know he'd had the injury just prior to that, again, similar to what he's recently had with ourselves. But yeah, Nick is an unbelievably effective goalkeeper. He makes saves that are breathtaking, is how I'd describe them. He's unbelievably controlled in pretty much every action that he does. He is very, very educated on the game. Takes a lot of information prior, wants a lot of information prior, but a lot of the time, you know, not just from us as a goalkeeping department, but he actually hunts that information out himself. So if we have a meeting about X or Y, a lot of the time he already comes into that meeting with his own ammunition about what he's seen personally. And I think that is, you know, it's tremendous when you think, I know that they have to go out there and they have to play in front of 52,000 fans, but to know that he's going away and he's thinking about the game as in-depth as what he does probably makes my job slightly easier to an extent. As a person, as a character, he's unbelievable around the training ground. He is loud. You can often be in one room and you can hear him laughing in the other. He's got such an infectious laugh. But around the place, he's one of the leaders of the group. One of the leaders of the group, heavily respected, you know, both by playing staff and obviously management staff and beyond. Just such a likeable character. Somebody that you look at and you just hope that everything goes well for him. Because again, he's just infectious in how he is as a person.
Didn't see it today in the session, but there is a type of Nick Pope save, I think I mentioned it to you when we spoke before, that he makes that you don't see a lot of other goalkeepers make, and it's that one where he's upright and he just chucks his shoulder out. And that, a classic Nick Pope save. I love seeing that.
Yeah, and again, that goes back to the fact he's such a effective goalkeeper. He makes split-second decisions like that, whereas I often revert back to me and how I played the games. I couldn't have done that. Whether it was the way I was taught coming through, and that's not to say that that's wrong by any stretch of the imagination, because it wasn't. But he's just got that natural ability to make them split-second decisions, and them split-second decisions, like 9 times out of 10, if not more, are correct. You know, he's a man mountain when you look at him as a man. You know, we spoke about that prior to coming on here, and, you know, physically, he's daunting. And I think he retains his height so well, particularly from the angles. And he relies on limb length to an extent. You know, he doesn't have to always go for push power, let's say, because he's so big. And I think that's something that is possibly lost on some younger goalkeepers, let's say, you know, upcoming goalkeepers that are coming through that might look at, you know, what looks at. Sometimes they might see some of the work that Nick does is not overly impressive because he makes it look straightforward, and they might want to make the explosive save. So you might have a younger goalkeeper who's 6'5", 6'4", but he wants to get himself into a low position from the angle because he wants to rely on his athleticism or his push power to make the save. Well, Nick's the perfect example to suggest that you don't need to do that, because if you stand tall and you obviously condense the area of the goal that you're defending because of the angle that you are on. So all of a sudden, 8 yards isn't 8 yards anymore. You're basically defending a 3 or maybe a 4 yard gate within that. Well, your limb length actually covers that. So anything on the lower half, Nick will rely on making a foot save or extending a leg toward the ball. And because of said limb length, he's always going to cover that 3 to 4 yard gate. Because he's retained his height and he's 6'6", anything that the forward would hit higher, he's obviously got that shoulder, that pec save, or also able to throw a hand out or even stick his head in front of the ball if necessary. But because he retains said height, it gives him optimal chance of actually defending that area of the goal.
What's quite interesting then is if you look at Nick Pope's style, you mentioned earlier that you were a very technical goalkeeper. Did you then become do you bring that into your goalkeeper coaching, technicality being a technical goalkeeper coach? Because I guess Nick, in a way, is slightly different to that in some ways.
Yeah,
I
would suggest so. I think you've got to try and find a balance between what the goalkeeper needs and also your own personal beliefs. Now, your own personal beliefs have then got to not take a backseat to an extent, but you've got to find the balance between the two. Is how I would suggest.
Because in some ways you want, technical to me would be wanting things to look nice on the eye. It's moving with fluidity. It's a certain range of athleticism. It's all about the visual, that type of stuff.
I think you need to look after the fundamentals. So the fundamentals of goalkeeping, whether it be Premier League level, whether it be anywhere else in the pyramid, you want the goalkeeper to make the expected save. So if there is a shot from around the edge of the area that might dip in front of the goalkeeper or might be in and around his face, you want them to either catch it or you want them to deal with it basically in the appropriate way. You want them to be reliable, assured, so the back line feels a level of confidence, everybody feels a level of confidence in what they can deliver in that regard. So you need to touch upon that throughout the working week. You need to have repetition with that throughout the working week, in my opinion. You can add in coordination, footwork movements. Again, they can be realistic to the match. They can be slightly different just so that you are working specifically on a coordination element. Then by the end of it, you want to kind of combine everything together so that you do have that match-related type practice. But yeah, going back to it, I think that you've got to have a balance of everything. I think that your week has got to be, yes, designed around the goalkeeper's needs in general. So how many days you have to lead into the game? What do they need to do? What do they need to see for them to be ready come a match day? And that's just not the number one. That has to be right the way throughout your department. So at the moment, we work with four goalkeepers all over the age of 30. Everybody is treading the same way. Everybody gets the, you know, the same repetition, the same type of practice, so that if the one wasn't available and the two had to step in, you'd like to think that they were in a position to step in and they know everything about what they might see at the weekend. They've obviously worked on it throughout that training week as well. If the two wasn't available and the three had to step in, they're also in a position to deliver exactly the same, having the same mindset, having the same level of work. And if it's not the three and for whatever reason the four has to step in, they're also in exactly the same position as well. So that's how we try and structure our week with that. But yeah, there's very, very many, let's say, different elements that you've got to kind of have added all in together.
And looking at it through different lenses.
Yeah, without a doubt, because every goalkeeper's profile is different. So, you know, you've got Nick, who's 6'6", who's going to play the game in a certain way. You've got Martin, who's 6'3", who's, you know, more of an explosive goalkeeper, unbelievably quick, unbelievable hands on him. Again, kind of on the technical aspect, you can tell Martin's had such a real technical upbringing, you know, out in Slovakia. As a young man, he's unbelievably quick around his goal. He's unbelievably explosive. Because of his profile, at times he maybe needs to play a little bit higher than Nick when he's facing a shot, because he doesn't have the same coverage in terms of limb length. But what he does have is an unbelievable explosive power to let himself get after things. And then you've got Loris after that. You've got Mark Gillespie after that. Everybody's got a different profile, and you've just got to work with, within your practice, what is best for them in terms of an outcome.
To quickly touch on your ascent. So you retired in 2018.
Yes.
Is that right? So yep. We're in 2024 now, and you are head of goalkeeping at Newcastle United. So just quickly run us through your brief journey, as it were.
So got offered the chance to go in with the under-23s at the time at Newcastle. So got to do that whilst also covering the day release programme. So basically the day release programme ran from the under-13s up until the under-16s at that time. So I was following the under-21s schedule, so matches, training programme, and also covering on an afternoon and evening the 13s to 16s programme. So that lasted for 2.5 years. So I had 2.5 seasons worth of doing that. Thoroughly enjoyed my time there. What I enjoyed about the academy setup was the fact that you worked with a smaller group of staff. So there was the head coach, the assistant head coach, like myself, the goalkeeping coach, sports scientist, physio, and kind of between the five of you guys, you know, you ran that team. So you'd have the goalkeeping element of the practice, but then you would also have some form of input into what was happening within the team. You would have a, you know, what they called at the time down there, like gang coaching. So you'd always have a role to play within some form of unit work. And it was a really, really enjoyable level of development for me, let's say. Really enjoyed my time doing that, and had some people down there that were great to learn from, but also, you know, kind of continue working with after the event. So Steve Harper, who's academy manager now, Steve Harper has been incredible for me. Steve was back up to Shea when I was a young lad here. So kind of between Harps and Kagi, you know, I kind of go back 22 years with those guys. So having Harps in that position there as academy manager was, you know, fantastic for my development at the back end not long before stepping up with the first team. We had the head coach had left, and we'd had like an interim period where Kevin Richardson, who was assistant head coach at the time, Kevin kind of took over first team duties, but Harps had let me step up and work alongside Kev. So from my perspective, getting the opportunity to step in and do that and, you know, lead so much more of the plan leading to a match, how the opposition looked, and kind of getting my teeth into that was such a good thing. And it lasted for a few months, and really, really enjoyed the level of detail that you could go into. And I think from that point, because I was always very happy coaching at the academy, I really enjoyed coaching the younger kids as well, you know, right the way down to the foundation phase. So foundation phase and youth development phase was probably the most enjoyment that I would actually get out of coaching. And I will go into that and give a little bit more detail into it, because I always remember as a young lad, I would train 5 nights a week. So Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, I'd be in at what was the Centre of Excellence at the time. On a Tuesday night, I would play for the City Boys team. On a Thursday night, I'd play for the school. On a Saturday, it was back with the City. And on a Sunday, because it was prior to Centre of Excellence, didn't have games at that time up until kind of under 14 level, I'd get to play for the boys club. So like my whole week was occupied around playing football. But the biggest thing that I always remember, you know, through, you know, getting the opportunity to work with, you know, Simon Smith, from going to Simon Smith goalkeeping as a 7-8 year old, to getting into the Centre of Excellence at under 9 and continuing to work with Simon, and then getting to work with Adam Sadler from that point and Terry Geno. I always remember the feeling of leaving school and how excited I was, because I was getting the chance to go to training. Like, I looked forward to going to training so much. And I think when I kind of got into that early stage of the coaching, is I wanted other people to feel the same way as I felt. So I wanted the 12, 13-year-old boys getting in their car with their dad and having the same type of experience that I had, like looking forward to coming like to the academy, looking forward to getting the session, the car journey home, what they'd talk about, what he'd learn. Like, you know, that gave me like such a buzz to be in a position that was similar to, you know, three people that I really idolised, because they gave me that experience as a young man. They made me fall in love, you know, with goalkeeping, with football. I've kind of ran away from a little bit of the question there, but yeah, I'll try and get back to where I was. So obviously after the 2.5 years, I actually got the chance to step up out of some sad circumstances, really. So Simon Smith was head of goalkeeping. I've alluded, obviously, I've had a great relationship with Simon. And unfortunately, if I remember rightly, I think it was his mother-in-law passed away in the January, and he needed a day off to attend the funeral. And I got a phone call from Simon the day before saying it had been signed off by the manager for me to take the session. And they were playing Watford at the weekend, so quickly tried to put something together on, you know, whether it was opposition tendencies or, you know, what had they worked on already in the working week? What did Simon want the session to look like? Put on a practice, briefly spoke to the manager at the end of the session, thanked us for coming up, said he enjoyed the little bit of the practice that he'd seen, went away. And it kind of all stemmed from there, really. So, yeah, we had, for the 23s that night, we had Redden. We were travelling down to Redden. We had them on the Friday night at the Majeski Stadium. And I got a phone call on the bus off Steve Harper saying he'd had a phone call off the manager to say he was really impressed with the work I'd done. He was impressed with whether it be my manner or the attitude that I'd shown going up to take the session. You know, for me, it was, you know, just an incredible opportunity to get the chance to go up and deliver to the senior goalkeepers. And he said that something might happen from there. That kind of obviously pricked my ears up a little bit. I knew he'd worked with two prior at Bournemouth, because he'd had Neil Moss at Bournemouth and Anthony White. And at that point, I'd just kind of finished doing my goalkeeping A licence, and both of those two were tutors. So I'd already had some good insight into, oh, what does the manager like? And just tried to get a little bit of information just in case the opportunity ever came where I kind of got that chance to step up in whatever capacity it was. Unfortunately for me, as a Newcastle fan, let's say, came into the first team environment, I got that phone call a few days later from the manager saying, could you start tomorrow? How would you like to change it all over and come and work up here? Jumped at the opportunity. But at the same time, it was scary because with the academy, and, you know, again, going back to the fact I'm a Northeast lad, there's security to an extent in an academy job. And also enjoyed doing that academy job. And we were joint bottom of the league it hadn't gone particularly well up to that point from the manager coming in. He'd had some good results, but yeah, I was looking at it and thinking I didn't want to obviously be part of something where things didn't go quite as they ended up did go, and thankfully, and being a part of something where, yeah, because I've got so many connections in the area and obviously so many people care about the football club, you know, it would have been a very difficult thing to have been a part of the staff that obviously ended up going down to the Championship with Newcastle. Luckily for me, I think I got in at such a good moment because the manager at that point had had a few months to try and implement what he was trying to work the team toward. So different formation, different style of press, different level of intensity. And I think that it all just kind of started to come together at that point. So first game was Leeds away, Elland Road. Unbelievable experience. We went and won the game 1-0. John Joe Shelby scored a late free kick. And then we were straight on a flight after that to go to Saudi Arabia for the week. So, you know, from basically the Thursday where I ended up starting, that was my first day in. Thursday, Friday match prep, game on the Saturday, flew to Saudi Arabia. And it was kind of a week into that trip where I was thinking, scratching my head, thinking, what is going on? Like, how has all this happened? Like, unbelievably lucky, unbelievably privileged to get the opportunity. Yeah, I became a little bit of a lucky omen because we went the next seven unbeaten. We won six and drew one. So that also helped kind of integrate me into the group with the coaches, because all of a sudden it's like you can keep coming every week because we keep winning.
Yeah, well, I mean, you certainly took the bull by the horns, because we'll go a bit deeper into it, because in the... Yeah, so it was 1-12, drew 2, lost 5. Like you said, joint bottom, ended in 11th. You kind of came into the role when Martin Dubravka was perhaps a bit low on confidence, you say. So in the 19 games prior to you, you arrived like smack bang in the middle of the season. 42 goals against and 1 clean sheet. In the 19 games thereafter, it was 20 goals against and 7 clean sheets. Then you move on to the next season. You've got Nick Pope coming in for 10 million. He gets 2 England caps in that time. He went through a period of not conceding in 10 games straight. You've got Champions League qualification. You've got EFL Cup final. You've got the fewest goals against per 90 in the Premier League. Second most Premier League clean sheets. Like, yeah, you had an impact. I think you should take the credit for this.
I think I was very fortunate in the time that I came in that, you know, so much was happening at the club. Manager came in on the back of new ownership. There was money spent. I think the squad was already in a good position prior to that. You know, we've had, or we still do have as well, so many good characters around the place. I think that so many people that are within these four walls care so much about this football club. A lot of the squad have been here for a good period of time as well. So some that were involved previously prior to the manager coming in, when Steve Bruce was in charge, when it was the Mike Ashley era, so many of those guys have been such a pivotal part of what's been achieved. And I include, obviously, Martin within that. From a goalkeeping perspective, we've obviously had Carl Dahl O'Brien. I know Carl's moved on now as well. But we've had so many people that have had, you know, such an influence, whether they've played on the pitch or not. That went such a long way in creating the atmosphere that's been created around the place. And, you know, last season particularly, we were on the crest of a wave. And I think a lot of that stemmed from the fact that there was so much harmony around the training ground, there was so much harmony around the stadium. Everything was connected, you know, through the fan base, into the players, into everything else that went on with the football club. And it still is, by the way. It still is.
There was one monumental moment in goalkeeping terms within all of this, and that is the aforementioned EFL Cup final, Carabao Cup final.
Yes.
Last season, where somehow, out of nowhere, I think, 20 months after he last played a competitive game, Loris Karius has to take the gloves against Manchester United. Just talk us through everything around that scenario, what it meant for you, how you had to manage that situation.
It was obviously totally unexpected. We had Liverpool on the Saturday at home, which was a big game in the Premier League. I think Liverpool at the time were in a position to try and chase down points to try and pull us back in. We were ahead of them in the race for Champions League football. So it was a huge game on the Saturday. So it was full focus on that Premier League event. And the thought hadn't even crossed anybody's mind, I don't think, because that was such an important game that if obviously we lost Nick, Carl Dahl at that point had gone out on loan to Hull. Martin Dubravka had been out on loan in the first part of the season, played 2 games for Man United in the Carabao Cup. And, you know, if there was anything that happened in that game to Nick, whether that be injury or suspension, he would have missed the cup final. But you know, from my personal point of view, that thought hadn't even entered my head. So when the event happened, we were already 2-0 down at that point. It hadn't been a great start. So 20 minutes in, we're 2-0 down. And Alisson catches a ball from a second phase, I believe, on a set play. And, you know, in their moments, you need to stop and play, and you've got Salah at the top end of the pitch. And it was something that had been discussed prior, but he'd been able to get himself in a position to play the side volley. Hits a lovely side volley in behind, and Nick plays the game incredibly well, the way that he kind of affects space and behind that back line. The way I describe him at times is, as a goalkeeper, you get told not to go looking for action, like let the action come to you. And Nick lets the action come to him, but he stalks out that moment. So he's so switched on. He's always positioned himself. He's always thinking about what's next. And for me, at times, he can be two, if not three, passes ahead of the actual sequence. So he's already reading something and where he thinks that ball is potentially going to be played, and he's already on the front foot. So when the ball gets played, he actually makes the right decision. So he's coming, he's getting there first. The problem being is when the ball bounces, it starts to veer away from him to the left side. And he just doesn't know at that point how to readjust and re-coordinate his feet. So I think originally he was going to go into a diving header. And then I think when he sees the bounces lower, he's kind of thinking, oh, how am I going to change and adapt to this? But at that point, it's too late. And then when he goes into what would be the world's lowest diving header, he doesn't get there. It hits his left hand. And then I'll be perfectly honest, everything from that moment within that game was a total blur, because the first thing that struck my mind is Nick was getting sent off, Martin was coming on, so there was a brief instructions to Martin. But then at that point, the realisation really struck me. It was like, okay, we're 2-0 down, we're down to 10 men in a pivotal game in the Premier League. But my mind had already switched that little bit, and whether it's rightly or wrongly in that moment, to, okay, we've got Lloris, we've got Mark, we've got Max Thompson. Nick can't play. Martin can't play. Carl's obviously out on loan, and there's obviously no recall there because, you know, the way everything works with the January window and what have you. And then that game kind of went by. We had a few chances. We nearly got back into the game, but yeah, it was a surreal experience. Surreal experience leading into it. And then, you know, the focus on the next week was the media attention around Lloris and, you know, the Champions League final and the errors that he'd made, and that was going to be something that was going to be uncontrollable to an extent. It was something where, you know, you tried to, or you wanted to keep that noise away from him. You wanted to build his confidence, but at the same time, I didn't want the week to look any different to what it would have looked for Nick. So it was trying to keep a level of familiarity with the actual workload that we were putting out on the training pitch. So that week leading into the game, 4-day lead into the cup final, I wanted my week to look no different than any other. Yes, you needed to get Lloris ready, but, you know, I would need to get Lloris ready in the same way that I would need to get Nick ready. And kind of going back to something that I said earlier in the pod is, you treat the four senior goalkeepers that you're working with, you treat them the same. They generally work in pairs, but you treat them exactly the same. They're all getting the same level of work throughout that week. They're all getting the, you know, whether that be the same technical work, whether that be the same level of in-possession work, whether that be the same level of work in terms of defending the area, reaction saves, protecting the goal. They're all doing exactly the same thing. It's just that one of them's turned out and playing the game on a Saturday. So for me, it just flipped into, well, okay, one of them's playing the game. It's just not Nick, it's not Martin, it's Lloris. That was kind of my thought process into it. And I tried to look at it as it was written in the stars. That's kind of the other take that, you know, I tried to look at from a personal point of view. And I thought, I'm going to look at this with an unbelievable level of positivity, because Lloris had obviously had such a tough time from that Champions League moment. Because if we talk about that and we strip that back a little bit, Lloris Carrison, where he'd got to in his career at that point, he was ready to go again. So it was his second year at Liverpool. His first year, he'd fought out with Simon Mignolet and kind of played roughly 50% of the games. In that second season, he played every game leading into the Champions League final. So he'd played 12 games, 13, including the final. He'd broken as Liverpool's number one. So at this point, he's played 70% of the Premier League games. He's played all of the Champions League games. If that game had went well for him on that night, I don't think that Liverpool went out that summer and spent £70 million on Alisson, because they've just had a goalkeeper that has won a battle against another top-level goalkeeper in Mignolet. He's played a Champions League final, which Liverpool have won. But unfortunately for him, the night goes different. He obviously, one, has the concussion moment, which was proven. He makes the mistake after that event with obviously the rollout and Benzema sticking his leg out and scoring the goal. He makes the mistake on Gareth Bale having the shot from distance that kind of squirms through. those events have now happened, and all of a sudden Loris Karius has gone from his career being at an incredible level to 8 weeks later, Liverpool have signed Alisson for 70 million and he's been sent out to the Turkish league with Beşiktaş on a 2-year loan. Now, psychologically, that must be incredible to have to try and get your head around. Absolutely incredible. So in terms of his strength of character, I've met nobody like him. He is unbelievably calm, unbelievably composed. And for somebody that's experienced that, you know, part of his demeanour probably stems from things that he's had thrown at him on the back of that event. So I had no concerns about how he was going to deal with the psychological impact of different things, because for me, it just seemed like it would be water off a duck's back for Loris. So it was just about preparing him in the right way physically and making sure that he had a certain level of information around Man United going into that game so he could best deliver a performance on the day. And for me, he didn't really put a foot wrong. Within the 90 minutes, he made some really good saves. There was probably one part or bits of media coverage that speculated whether he could have done better with the second goal, where Rashford hits the shot, it gets deflected, it kind of goes in under the crossbar into the roof of the net. Maybe he's a bit low in that moment, but you kind of go back to the point that you made earlier. He hadn't played a competitive game of football for 20 months. So you haven't played a competitive game of football for 20 months. So what's going to happen is you're going to play a Wembley final in front of 90,000 people. It's live on television, millions watching across the world. Media speculation and coverage is highlighted towards you as being the calamity goalkeeper that made said mistakes 5 years ago in a Champions League final. All the pressure is firmly on your shoulders, and you've been able to go out and deliver that level of performance. For me, I think he deserves nothing more than credit and a pat on the back. I really do, because that is an unbelievable, unbelievable environment to be put in.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree. I would love to know if, and it shouldn't be a thing, but was there any comment made about his choice of gloves?
Well, the gardening gloves. Yeah. No, I mean, Loris has been, you know, he's, what's the word, is it extrovert? Like, yeah. You know, he's a, like I said, he's a cool character. You see it in his hair. His tattoos, like, he is one cool guy, let's say. See it in his choice of clothing. Yeah, he's been wearing, let's say, a few interesting pairs of gloves. But you know what? If anybody can pull them off, he can.
Yeah.
I'm not sure he pulled them off, mind. I'm not quite sure.
That's it, right? It's all part of branding, right? But yeah. I just, in that moment, I felt like there was so much scrutiny on him. And it was almost a case of, you know, pick your battles, in a way.
I was going to say, I think that probably explains his character more than anything, though, because there's so much scrutiny on you, and you're like, you know what, I'm going to wear these brown gloves. I do not care what you think. I don't care what you think, and I don't care what you say. And I think that's Loris. This is me. Accept me for this, or don't. I'm not really bothered either way. That's, I think, how he sees life in general. And I've got to say, I love it about him. I do.
You mentioned there how all four goalkeepers are treated the same, or treat the same, as you would say, which I like. Is the dynamic, though, in that situation where you've got your one and two, who would ordinarily be playing at the weekend, and your three and four, who are there in a sense to support the one and two, that's flipped. So is that a weird dynamic? Then you've then got Nick and Martin, not on the periphery of things, but knowing that they're not going to be playing and therefore servicing more the three and the four.
Yeah, it was, because, again, when you're going to one of those moments, I guess that you expect neither to be on the training ground. But both were. So, yeah, that was interesting. But again, going back to both characters, Nick and Martin, like, they were unbelievably supportive. And you've got to remember that, you know, the opportunity's just been taken away from Nick. Nick's played, you know, in all of the rounds. He made penalty saves against Crystal Palace in one of the early rounds. Carl Darlow had played the first game against Tranmere. But beyond that, Nick had played all the games. So, you know, we beat Bournemouth, we beat Leicester. You have the doubleheader against Southampton. Nick's in goal for everyone, and then you get obviously the cup final in the main event. The game that Nick would or should have been playing, let's say, gets taken away on the back of a bizarre error or bizarre moment, let's say, the week prior. So I think from my point of view, it was about making sure that he was right mentally. So the one thing that we did do that was probably slightly different than anything else was at the early part of the week, so on the match day -4, we kind of separated into two groups. We done the same practice, and that was right away across the coaching department. So there was me, there was Schwan Jalal, Danny Garcia, the goalkeeping analyst, Tony Keogh, the head of academy goalkeeping, Ben Ascroft, who was PDP goalkeeping coach at the club as well. We all had a hand in
doing and delivering the same practice, but one worked on the left side, one worked on the right side, and then they would flip over. And we got all the academy goalkeepers up for that as well. So one, it meant we could kind of deliver a realistic practice where you might have kind of six bodies and you're able to deliver a two or a three ball sequence on one side that kind of replicated a certain level of, you know, realistic match play. And then it would obviously flip over to the same practice on the other side. But I tried to do that to, yes, one, have that level of realism across the board on both. But for Nick, because Nick had mentioned two of the younger goalkeepers at the club that he hadn't had the chance to see yet, but he'd heard good things about. So I deliberately brought them up and put them in Nick's group because I wanted that to take a little bit of the focus away from, you know, the fact that he wasn't going to be playing in the game, and it was going to give him something to kind of help them with within that, you know, first day or two, where he could look at them and he could be that kind of supportive figure, not just for Loris and Mark leading into the game, but also he had a focus with the two younger lads where he could obviously, you know, deliver certain parts of information, kind of have a little look at what they do, how they play the game. There's one with a similar profile to Nick. So, you know, I'd already discussed that with him prior. Now you might be able to, you know, drop in X or Y and deliver a little bit of information that's going to obviously support his journey. So I just tried to do something that would, yeah, give him a different thought pattern for that first day or two, so that when the tactical element came in, you know, hopefully he'd got his head around the fact that, you know, the weekend wasn't there for him.
It's almost election day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at COTA.com.
Lifted in by Taylor. And it comes to Donaldson. Parkler with an outstanding stop to deny his former teammate.
You mentioned some of the staff members now that you have within your team. That was one of your primary goals, right? When you first got the job, it's to expand that department.
It was, yeah. So when I had the interview for the job, because, you know, people might just expect because I worked with Simon, I came up, I just got given the job. I didn't have to interview for the job once Simon left the football club, which was, by the way, an unbelievable experience. You're working it day to day, but I still had to sit with Dan Ashworth, Steve Harper and Dominica, who's head of the HR department. I had to deliver a full presentation about what I would want the department to look like, what I'd want to bring to the department or felt I could bring to the department, what I wanted certain things to look like. And one of those things was, you know, right across that youth level, I think the best thing that you can do is obviously get into the kids and make sure that they've got the right development path from as young as you can. So at the time of me stepping up, so originally there was Simon Smith, who was head of goalkeeping. So Simon worked alone with the first team. There was me with the under-23s, which is now the under-21s. There was Danny Garcia, who was the under-18s goalkeeping coach. Then I covered the day release program. And then we had two kind of part-time sessional coaches that between them would try and cover the Monday to Friday nights. But there was a lot of times that there wasn't a goalkeeping coach present because we didn't have either people with the need. So my job role, for example, or Danny's job role, for example, didn't give us that level of responsibility. So a lot of what we'd done was off our own back at that point. So filling in evening sessions, it wasn't within the job remit, let's say. We would do that because we felt it was the right thing to do, or we felt that we wanted to, you know, work and implement certain things with the younger goalkeepers. So one of the big things for me was to try and expand and make sure that we had that coverage. So within that interview, Tony Kagan came in at that point as head of academy goalkeeping. That was one thing that was crucial as well, because when I was down there, I wasn't head of academy goalkeeping, I was the under-23 goalkeeping coach. Danny was the under-18 goalkeeping coach. So there was actually nobody that was, like, I didn't have more authority over him. He didn't have more authority over me. There was nobody actually leading the goalkeeping side of the department down there. We'd get our heads together and we'd try, like, the best to make sure that everything was covered. But realistically, it was neither of our remit to do so. So one thing that I'd said for the department, particularly down there, was I wanted three full-time if possible. So we had Tony Cake, head of academy goalkeeping. We then got ourselves into a position where we could appoint and brought Ben Ascroft in from Fleetwood Town. And then we were able to bring in Amrik Hare as well as a specialist for the foundation level. So Amrik currently covers the under-9s to 14s. They've been doing sterling work down there, and I think the proof's been in the pudding with some of the younger goalkeepers that we are starting to bring through into the senior level now, let's say.
Very important, yep. The growth of a goalkeeping department. Yes. Very important.
Yes. Senior levels, obviously, something as well. So going back to, you know, Simon worked individually, then I came in and assisted Simon. So there's now myself, Shwan Jalal's came in as first-team goalkeeping coach. Danny is now the goalkeeping analyst. The fact that Danny can be on the grass and help serve and things as well and kind of have a little bit of a dual responsibility there is also very beneficial for the practices you can put on. And we've also been in a position where we've been able to bring Craig Musham in as well as goalkeeping S&C coach. So, you know, at the first team level now, we've got four working on a full-time basis. At the academy, we currently have three, and we're looking to hopefully make that four as well. So the department's expanded, and I'm hoping that there's going to be more to come as well over the next 12 to 24 months.
And what's become apparent, the more you go into football clubs now, those building blocks from foundation through to first team, from everyone singing from the same hymn sheet, from having a, you know, a fully formed technical program that is right from the beginning to the very end.
I think that's huge. That's something that we sat down and put together. And that wasn't just something that was done by me. There was something that was put together originally from myself and Simon. So we had like a little bit of the foundation of the work that we wanted to put together. And the good thing about Simon is, I mean, Simon wrote the book on goalkeeping, especially on a technical aspect. Like Simon was, you know, in my opinion, he's second to none in that regard. So to have been able to sat with Simon originally and kind of put something together that would work right the way, not just from senior, well, from senior level right the way down to foundation level, the terms and the technical terminology and certain practices that we felt would be very, very beneficial to implement right the way through the club. We were then able to add to that. So I sat down with Tony Keogh. Schwan wasn't in the department at the time, but Ben Ascroft was. And we sat down between the three of them, and we kind of looked through it and thought, is everybody comfortable with this? Is anything we would take out? Is there anything we could add just to kind of try and refine it to something that everybody was comfortable with? Because the one thing about alignment is if I'm in this building and they're in that building, they need to be comfortable with what they're saying and what they're delivering. If they don't believe in it, there's no point in them delivering it, in my opinion. So I think it had to be something where there was a buy-in from everybody, and for there to be a buy-in from everybody, everybody's got to contribute to it. I wouldn't like to be somebody that just handed something out and said, that's what I want, that's what we're going to do, let's crack on from there. That's just not how it works. That's not how people feel valued as well. So everybody got their part of input within that technical terminology. The way it's all been put together as well by Danny with video footage, so everybody can not just see the terminology but can see an example from a senior goalkeeper at the club doing said action as well. We've got that right the way across for basically every action. We've got a level of core practices that are running from senior level down to foundation level as well. Some are slightly modified to make it obviously age relevant, but just so that right the way throughout, everybody on a, you know, whether it be a technical aspect, whether it be a tactical aspect, whether it be in possession, out of possession, however it might look, everybody is singing off the same hymn sheet, not in terms of only what they're saying, but in terms of what they're delivering as well.
It's almost election day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at COTA.com.
This is Greg Cunningham. As the cross comes in, it's Pringle on the far post, and he's forced to save from Adam Bartlett.
We're nearly at the end, but you were a player for a long time. So we've got a quiz coming up, by the way. So that will come at the end, followed by Richard Lee's final question, because he likes to have the final word. But you were a player for a long time. So you were 10 years at Newcastle.
Yep.
You were released. Obviously, you mentioned you trained alongside Shay Given, Steve Harper, many others. But at the end of that, which I'm guessing a few lads that listen to this podcast might be able to relate to, you could not find a club.
No, I trialed. So where did I go? I went to Leeds on trial. Nothing came of that. Doncaster Rovers on trial. Nothing came of that. I trialed at Boston United. Nothing came of that. I was probably used by a few teams to a certain extent, playing games and, oh, come and play this reserve game, come and play this under 19 game. And as a young lad, you're looking for a club and you go and play the game and then nothing comes of it and you get demoralised on the back of it. So went through that period where I was going on trial to places, nothing stuck. The one that ended up kind of pushing me in a different direction was I got a phone call to go to Dundee United. Got the phone call on a Sunday, could he come up and train? Got the train up that night, arrived, stayed in the club digs, trained on the Monday, got pulled in kind of the Monday afternoon. We were looking into a goalkeeper, didn't believe we'd get him. It was nine in the fire, it came off. Thank you very much for coming, but he's signing and there's your train fare, and off I went back down the road. So that was one where it made me look elsewhere. I actually signed to play in the US. So I signed to play for a club called the Rochester Rhinos, which Jamie Vardy recently acquired.
Okay.
I'm not sure what's happening with it now, but so they were in the USL at the time. So I went out on a 3-week trial, loved it. The money wasn't fantastic, but I just thought everything that would come out of, you know, the opportunity to go out and hopefully play games out in the USL could have been, you know, the next step that I needed. And it was basically, you know, on the same hand, the only professional contract that I'd been offered. So it was the only chance that I had of staying in the professional game. Went out to the US in the March, and that's another interesting story if you want us to tick that box.
I had no idea that you'd been in the US.
Yeah, well, I kind of was there and I wasn't there.
Okay.
So basically the club were changing stadiums. They'd just gone into an 18,000 all-seater, you know, like soccer stadium, let's say, because they had been playing at the baseball ground. So they were moving into this new stadium, and basically they asked me to send everything out. They would be dealing with the work permit, the visa aspect side of things. I'm a young 19-year-old, very naive, send everything out. Don't think there's a problem. I'm, you know, in touch with the team manager every other week, having a little catch-up via the phone. And I get a phone call to say, you can come out from, I think it was roughly around about the 2nd or the 3rd of March. You can come out, we'll be starting pre-season. If you have any problem at immigration, hand this letter over. We're going to send you a letter. So I'm thinking, all right, okay. So I haven't been down to the embassy in London. Again, going back to the naivety level, I'm 19-year-old. I didn't even realise I needed to go down to the embassy in London. You know, the club were handling everything. So hand over this letter. So I fly Newcastle, Amsterdam, Amsterdam to Detroit, get pulled in by immigration in Detroit. Why are you here? So I hand over this 2-year professional contract signed by me, the club, the league. Oh yeah, everything seems in order. We've just got to check with the embassy to make sure that everything's being processed with the visa and the work permit application. So they come back roughly 20 minutes later. I'm sorry to notify you of this, but your work permit was only applied for 3 weeks ago. Okay, what does that mean? Well, it takes 3 months to process. Right, okay. Panicked in that moment. Well, I've been told to give you this letter. Hand over the letter. Again, hadn't opened it. Whether that was naivety again, I'm not sure, but hadn't opened said letter. Give them the letter. And the letter said, Adam was on an extended 8-week trial. If he was successful, they were going to send me over the border to Toronto, to the British Embassy in Canada, to get the work permit and the visa. So basically, the club knew that they'd messed up, didn't want to inform me of the mess up. So I've already handed over a 2-year contract. So at this point, it becomes fraudulent. Yeah, in the immigration room, they said, listen, we've got one of two choices now. The main thing is you've got to go back to where you came from. Right, okay, what does that mean? Well, here's your two choices. You can either pay to get back home, which will be, I think it was roughly around about $1,800 to get back on the next plane and go back. Or I could go back, be barred from the US for the next 5 years and barred from KLM Airlines for life.
Oh my
goodness. So as a young lad, I've had to pay that money out.
You were reimbursed for that, surely?
No, because the contract stated, the contract commenced upon arrival. So all they said was I didn't arrive. So yeah, so again, that was kind of where it ended and came back. It ended up kind of affecting the next step as well, because at that point, the representative I was with at the time managed to get me into the Superettan in Sweden. So the level below the Prem out there at a club called Västerås. And basically, because of what had happened in the turnaround, my suitcases, I was, you know, I took everything that I owned, every possession I owned. I was a 19-year-old lad. I didn't own much, but every pair of boots I had, every pair of gloves I had, everything kind of was going out you know, to Rochester. So that had carried on. My suitcase didn't come back for 3.5 weeks. So I was back in the UK waiting. At this point, everything had fell through with the US. They basically had paid money to take it to a tribunal. So I pretty much remember it word for word. They said that I was not a high enough caliber of player to bring over from the UK, and it would be more beneficial for US soccer to pull one of their own out of the college or university setup. So I got denied the work permit. Everything got cancelled, signed to play in Sweden, had to wait for the suitcase and everything to come back prior to going out there. So I arrived there 2 days before the start of the season. The international clearance had obviously already transferred to the US, so we had to wait for the international clearance to come back. So I missed the first game. And at that point, they went on like a 14 or 15 game unbeaten run. So I never even got the chance to knock on the manager's door and say I wanted an opportunity in the team, because the guy that was playing, big fella called David Vilkstrom, was playing unbelievably well. The team weren't losing. So we got there, they had like a mid-season summer break in Sweden. I just cancelled the contract and came home. So an incredible, incredible few months, let's say. But yeah, so yeah. And the other, like, you laugh about now, like, obviously it wasn't funny at the time, but it's funny now. The best part about that story is 2 days before I went, I had a leaving party.
Oh, no.
So you've had this leaving party, all your friends and family there, like, 4 days later, I'm back. Hi, everyone. So there was that. And then when it all happened, like, getting back on the plane, so I got police escorted to my seat in Detroit, like, heading back. Like, police escorted, so, like, everybody's looking at me. And, like, I'm a young rogue at the time as well. I think I had a bit of a skinhead, and I was wearing, like, a black Adidas tracksuit, so I probably looked like a bit of a wrong'un. So, yeah, police escorted back to my seat. So flight lands, then that flight went to Paris. Police get on. I get police escorted off the plane. So I'm then stood at the top of, like, obviously, a jumbo jet, big plane. I'm stood at the top of the stairway when literally every other passenger gets off the plane. I'm stood between these two police officers, and I got took to like an underground cell for 4 hours before I then got escorted to the next flight. I remember in there, I had a picture on my phone, and it was from when I went to Milan with Newcastle, and I was basically on the pitch and Laurent Robert was taking a shot. And I was trying to show the guys, just to try and say, like, look, I'm not like a convict. I'm not a criminal. Like, this is all a big misunderstanding. Yeah, there's Laurent Robert. Yeah, hey, there's Laurent. That's me. But, yeah, incredible moment, let's say.
Wow, that's remarkable. Yeah. Gosh, that's incredible. What a story. What a story. Okay, I mean, there's so much more to dig into, but we're running out of time, so we'll quickly move on. Although I'd like to know, especially now, because you are a goalkeeper coach and you are focused very heavily on that pathway from, you know, youth into first team football, be that loans coming through from step three, step two, step one into the English Football League system. But why do you think, after you were released from Newcastle, so prior to this ordeal happening, why do you think that you couldn't find a club?
I think the stigma around height, to an extent, you know, going into league clubs, if you're going to be, you know, I'm 6 foot, if you're going to be a goalkeeper that is 6 foot, you have got to be exceptional, really exceptional in my opinion. You've got to have so many standout super strengths across the board that kind of probably makes up for the fact that you're genetically not maybe what they wanted. You know, you look at goalkeepers across the board now, and, you know, height is a factor. Ultimately, as sad as it is, you know, it is a factor. You've got to say that. And I remember one particular moment, I went on trial at Rotherham United just after I'd been released. I went into the office on this trial at Rotherham, and Mick Harford was the manager, and he was on the phone to somebody else. Peter Beardsley had sorted the trial out, because Peter had the involvement of the academy at the time at Newcastle. Peter had sorted this trial out with Mick, and he was on the phone. And just as he was getting off the phone, as somebody said, can I call you back? I've got a young goalkeeper here I need to speak to. I was told he was 6'1", looks more like 5'10". I felt I had a good week when I was in there, but realistically, you probably knew from that, you know, one off-the-cuff comment, whether I was being humorous or however it was, you know, like I said, there's always that stigma attached with a smaller goalkeeper, where you've got to be really, really exceptional if you're going to have a career at the top end. Like I said, you look at goalkeepers that have your Shea Givens, your Fabian Barthez's, Claudio Bravo, like, they've all got something where you can pinpoint what they are phenomenal at. And I just, unfortunately for me, I wasn't phenomenal at anything.
Well, okay. Right, we're going to finish on a quiz, like I said, and then Richard Lee's final question. The quiz is, Adam Bartlett, how well do you know you? Cue the music. You made your EFL debut on the 8th of August 2009. Who was it against and what was the score?
Morecambe Way 2-2.
Now, this isn't going to be part of the quiz, but it's just interesting that you made your second EFL debut, if you can call it that, for Hartlepool, on exactly the same day, 6 years later, in 2015. Remarkably, who was it against?
Morecambe at home 2-0.
And who was in the opposite goal on both days?
Barry Roach.
Of course he was. 4 marks already, very good. In what season were you named Blyth Spartans Player of the Season?
2007-2008.
On the 1st of June 2007, you made your England C debut as a sub against which country?
Finland.
Who was the goalkeeper you replaced that night?
Oh, I'm going to get this one wrong, but Lance Cronin?
You did not get it wrong. Correct. 4 marks so far. I think this is the first time this has happened. Interestingly, a few years prior, someone else made 4 appearances for England C in the 05-06 season. This isn't part of the quiz. It's just interesting to note that it was. You might know him from this place.
Simon Wellison?
Shwan Jalal.
Oh.
Something for you to speak about next time. Over the post-match.
I should have got that.
Where do Kidderminster Harriers play their home games?
Agbara.
What does Newcastle Brown Owl's famous five-pointed blue star represent? This could be where we fall down.
It is. It's going to be, yeah.
It is.
I've got nothing.
The 5 founding breweries that were brought together in 1890 to form Newcastle Breweries Limited. Who knew? What was the sponsor on the shirts of Darlington during your time there?
I can see it. I just can't see it. No, I need... Oh, one of them was... No, Virgin?
Virgin Trains.
Yeah.
Correct. I'll give you that. I'll give you that. 2 more. In which division did you play the most of your 500 plus appearances?
National League North.
It's actually the National League.
Ooh, okay.
So I have it down as 187
okay.
National League, 169 National League North, and 132 League Two.
Okay.
Okay.
Nice.
Do you concur with that?
Yeah.
And finally, just a spot of don't forget the lyrics. So give me the next line of this song. Sitting in a sleazy snack bar sucking sickly sausage rolls, slipping down slowly, slipping down sideways, think I'll sign off the dole.
I've got nothing. I've got nothing. I'm terrible with music, terrible with lyrics. Yeah.
Very good scores there. I think that's probably the best score we've had.
Okay.
Yeah. And to finish, Richard Lee's final question, which he always likes to ask. Take it away, Richard.
Yes, we get to the part of the show that everybody has been looking forward to. No doubt we'll have disregarded most of what has happened before because I only want to know the answer to one question. And that question, Mr. Adam Bartlett, or Barts, as you are known to everybody in the goalkeeping fraternity, is what has goalkeeping given you?
Everything, as silly as that sounds, or as corny as that sounds, let's say. But no, like goalkeeping has been my life from not just going to Simon Smith goalkeeping as a 7-year-old and 8-year-old, but I've got an older brother. He's 3 years older than me. So from the moment that he really started playing football, we had a goal in the back garden. And basically I got pushed in goal right from the off. So from a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old, of having my older brother taking shots at me in the garden, even stemming right the way back from that moment there, my life has been goalkeeping in a roundabout way, right the way from that point, you know, right the way through the, you know, as a young lad, thinking about the 92-93 championship season, Pav in goal, Tommy Wright in goal as well, kind of the flip-flop between the two partway through that season. The entertainers, you know, the goalkeeping strips that we spoke about there. I remember the 94 World Cup. You know, that was the first World Cup in terms of what I remember. And I remember going to the field with my friends and what would I have been at that point? I would have been, what, 8 years old at best? And I'm going to the field with my friends and I remember wearing, remember when you had your school shorts were grey and your school socks were grey? Mm-hmm. And I got my mum to buy us a grey T-shirt so I could go to the field and be Taffarel because Brazil had an all-grey goalkeeping strip at that World Cup and all of, if not, you know, yeah, I was going to say most of, if not all of my childhood memories are revolved around goalkeeping. Like whether it be, you know, at the field with your friends playing heads and volleys, whether it be playing singles, doubles, like everything revolved around me with a pair of gloves on, me being in goal. I had no interest in being an outfield player. I had no interest in taking shots. I wanted people to take shots at me. Everything for me has been about trying to make them saves, trying to, you know, command your back line, communicate. I always love communicating and kind of shouting at people and trying to give people, whether that be encouragement, information, you know, I just, everything about what I've done in that regard has just been about trying to keep the ball out of the back of the net. So, yeah, for me, it's give everything.
Adam Bartlett, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Lot going on around the penalty spot, comes in. Anderson's header. Good save, Bartlett.
Coda salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free, Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of Coda's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use Coda Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on Coda. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.